Hello, everyone. All right, we had a good lab lecture this morning. I am now on my second cup of tea. Let's see. Let me block out the light from my window. It's getting a bit strong. Let's block this window out real quick. Make it a little easier to see me for the recording. All right, I'm in the dark dungeon now. Lights on, recording's good. And hey, how's it going? Okay, Linnea threw in there from the chat. She said, I offered to hold an additional SI since her Wi-Fi melted down on Friday. So you guys can talk about that. Would you guys prefer hours today after the afternoon lab or the option to extend hours as needed tomorrow on the regular SI? All right, so you guys can add into the chat there. If you weren't looking at the chat, you can respond to Linnea and see what it is you all want to do. Or you can send her a private message too, if you want to do it that way in the chat. All right, we are on Monday, April 20th, and we just finished our introduction to Chapter 6, which was our first day on Chapter 6 with energy and things. I'm thinking, so I'm looking back, seeing what we had done. And and looking at what we need to do, let's do a warm up with some curved arrows. Let's look at a little more filling in arrows. And I didn't have this one ready to go. So we're gonna draw each one of these steps and figure out where the arrows need to go. So this is sort of reaction mechanism. The idea today is that I want to go through a little bit more of curved arrows. We'll look at some reversible versus irreversible steps. And then we'll get into Chapter 7 fairly quickly. We'll do some nomenclature things. We'll do some different functional groups. And then start looking at some substitution reactions. We'll look at a lot of examples. We'll talk about SN1, SN2. Some reaction theory. We've got some good topics for today. So just a quick warm up on curved arrows. Let's do this. So we'll have a group here that's got a positive charge and a proton and a hydroxyl group. And what I want to do is I want to take that proton to create this group. Okay, so where does the curved arrow have to go? What do we have to do here? Where do the arrows go? This is hard in terms of question and answer in the way that I would normally do it. But the first thing is we take the proton. Second thing is we give the electrons back to where the negative charge goes. So it's not enough just to take the proton. We also have to give the electrons back to the carbon and make sure the electrons go back to the carbon. Okay, second step, what I want to do is attack a group such that what I make is a new bond and do this. Okay, so the idea is to find the arrows and figure out where the arrows go and how to make this happen. So what we have is a new bond that is here. And so the arrows are going to go attacking the carbon, breaking the bond, and shifting the electrons up onto the oxygen. Sequence of steps. now going to this guy. So the next step here is a proton transfer, where we take the proton and requires two arrows, one arrow giving the electrons back to the oxygen. That would have been easier to see had I had the negative charge on the oxygen down below. It would have made a little more sense. Next step is removing a proton, so we want to go to this. And the question is, how do we get from point A to point B this time? So I'm going to take this hydroxyl group. This isn't actually where I wanted it. I'm just going to delete that. We'll throw the hydroxyl group up here. A little bit easier to see where things go now. All right, so now what we need to do, this is a harder one, trying to figure out what's happening. So we have this new bond that we kind of created, and now the difference is that we have two new bonds. And the other difference is that this proton is missing over here. And so this is a proton, a deprotonation step. And so we're going to take the proton, we're going to shift the electrons in, and we're going to shift the electrons from this nitrogen, breaking them from here, and we're going to shift them up onto the nitrogen. So we can see that the lone pair is now here, and we have the two double bonds, and the bond that is missing is the bond that was there. Ooh, I have that new handy pointer now that they added. The bond that was here, that was the double bond, is now gone, and that has been moved up into the lone pair on the nitrogen. Okay, next step. And why am I going through these? It's just to practice arrow pushing, to draw multiple steps and to look at how we actually do arrow pushing. And we can go back and we can add names to these things in a minute. So now what we're going to do is another sequence. And we want to push the arrows in a way that are going to take us from this guy up here down to the structure down here. So we're going to be adding in a new bond that's there. We're also going to get the double bond back, and our positive charge is going to come back. So we want to make sure that we get all of those. So this mechanism starts with arrows going from the lone pair, pushing in to regenerate the double bond. That was not supposed to happen that way. These striking out and bonding to the carbonyl carbon, and these lifting up and going onto the oxygen. So three arrows in order to get to that next structure down at the bottom. Let's see, next step is and I'm sure you're all going at this point, what the heck is going on here? And the idea is that sometimes these reaction mechanisms are long, Where did the second oxygen come from? Ooh, second oxygen came from here. So it was the oxygen that is in this second carbonyl that I'm bringing in a new carbonyl that is this oxygen that is here. That's where the second oxygen came from. These are just looking at these as a sequence of steps and just trying to figure out what arrows are needed to go from one step to the next. And so the arrows that are taking us, if we look at the differences, it's sort of mapping out the differences each time. Differences are proton, which is here, now bound to here, and the hydroxyl group, this guy, now just hanging out down here. And this is just a proton transfer where we take the proton, but we also have to clip the bond and give the electrons back to the oxygen. That's where the negative charge comes from that's on there. And the colors, while I feel are helpful, oops, that was supposed to be erase whole. While the colors are helpful for tracking those differences, they sometimes get in the way of trying to see what's going on in each step. All right, let me bring in, I think this is our last step. Yes, okay. So this step goes to, back to this. Did I lose a group? I did. I don't want to lose that group. And then this has, this that comes off. Okay, so in this last step, clearly what's happening here is that a bond is breaking. So this bond is going to break and disappear because the two molecules have now fragmented. So what has to happen in order for that to happen is the electrons have to, oh, let's draw this out so we can see it a little bit better. We got to see this proton. So what we're going to do is we're going to take the proton, we are going to break the bond, the electrons are going to flow in to make the carbonyl. So that's the bond that is generated that is there. This bond is going to fragment, not there, but here, breaking, and the electrons are going to go back to the carbon. That's where the negative charge came from there. And as that whole group comes off, it comes off as the carbonyl that is drawn there. So each one of these steps, it's like we could take these steps and just adding in the curved arrows and tracking curved arrows. It's just an exercise in tracking curved arrows and understanding where electrons are going each way, so that we could take any of these steps and arrows and ask you to add the arrows into the step. And that's the skill set that we're kind of asking there for. And this was a much more complicated example of a reaction mechanism. It's called a thiazol ring. And it's one of the reaction mechanisms that we do later on in the lab, second semester in lab rather than first semester. But it just exemplifies a complex reaction mechanism that you guys may not be ready for just yet in terms of being able to track where everything goes, but that's what we're moving towards, is we're moving towards being able to write out complicated reaction mechanisms and being able to understand the steps and being able to draw the reaction arrows and to read this. And within a couple of weeks, you guys are going to be able to just read these diagrams and throw the arrows in and do that fairly naturally. And I like to show the example that while it may seem confusing right now, it actually is going to be fairly simple for you a little bit later. It's just, this is what we're working towards. So Finn, how do you know when to stop? Because you just keep adding water. This is a reaction mechanism where I knew what the product is and where this reaction is going, and that the thiazole ring is actually a catalyst, and that the catalyst gets, if we look at this piece right here, that piece is regenerated at the end of the reaction. And what happens is two molecules wind up getting stitched together. So the overall reaction that I was doing was taking two of these aldehydes and through that catalyst, stitching these two aldehydes together such that what I get is the two aldehydes stitched together, and the new bond that is created is this new bond between them. And the catalyst is that thiazole ring catalyst. Oops, that has, oh, I did it wrong there. 1 second, we'll get it right. Too many bonds. There we go. Positive charge there. A group there. Something's still not right. Ah. All right, one more time. I got to draw it from scratch or my brain just won't do it. Which is funny because it's just sitting up above here staring at me. There we go. That guy, positive charge, that bond, negative charge. That's the catalyst. And it's just a way of stitching these two molecules together. And all of the hydrogens are still accounted for, so that if I look at the hydrogens that are here and here, one of those hydrogens is here and the other one is still present where it was located. So the two hydrogens are still there, and all the carbons are still accounted for, and this is the new bond that was generated. So all of that reaction mechanism was just a way of using a catalyst to bring two aldehydes together into a beta hydroxy ketone. And it's just a nice reaction mechanism to show you guys, to show you how complex these reaction mechanisms get, but also that we can revisit this, and I'll remind you about how challenging maybe this was to follow when we get into second semester and we do this again. And you'll see how easy it is to follow the second time through. And we can go through and we can add all of those reaction mechanism names that we had. This one is protonation. Or actually deprotonation. I should just add a removing the proton. Deprotonation. Nucleophilic attack. Followed by a protonation and a deprotonation. Nucleophilic attack. Protonation. And then loss of leaving group. And that's the end of the reaction mechanism. So each one of these steps are steps that we discussed individually. It's just seeing them sort of in a larger context. Okay, I wanted to do that just as sort of like a warm-up, and because I wanna bring that back in a little bit later. Okay, in chapter six, they do a lot of carbocation rearrangements. It's 6.11. Our carbocation rearrangements. And they address them sort of out of context as individual steps. And we're going to skip this for right now. We're going to come back and we're going to hit this in chapter 7 in context. So ignore 6.11 right now and skip the carbocation rearrangements. But what I do want to hit, what I do want to talk about a little bit is reversible versus irreversible steps. So let's look at a couple of steps here. Reversible versus irreversible. Many of the reaction steps that we will look at will be reversible, and many will be irreversible. And so it's a good idea to understand what different steps look like and why something may be reversible versus why something may not be reversible. For instance, if I have a carbocation and that carbocation gets attacked by water in a nucleophilic attack, and what I make out of this is something that goes to be tetrahedral, the new bond, and then the hydroxyl group, which is bound to it, but still protonated. This step is considered to be reversible because the group that has attached is not strongly attached. This is a good leaving group and can come back off again. And so we would say that because of this, this step is reversible. Let's do reversible in blue. Let's look at another example, and then we can draw some conclusions as to kind of what we're seeing here. If I take a methyl group that is a methyl anion, a carbanion, and I attack this carbon because of its partial positive. So these are both nucleophilic attacks, and the electrons move up on to the oxygen. This step is irreversible. Because what it leads to is a product where the group is a poor leaving group. So a methyl group is a very poor leaving group. And because that group can't come back off, we say that this step is irreversible. So understanding what is a good leaving group and what is a poor leaving group helps me to understand a little bit about what is a reversible step versus an irreversible step. Let's see, Francisco, is the bond weak because it's next to an electron withdrawing group with a positive charge? It has to do with what our definition of good leaving group versus poor leaving group is. Let's do it this way. A good leaving group good leaving group equals a weak base. So when we look at the leaving group, for instance, if we have a hydroxyl group that comes off, but it's coming off as water, so this thing is positively charged, and I break the bond and it comes off, I get the carbocation back. And the group that came off is a water molecule. This is a weak base. This has a pKa that is around 15.7. If I look at the other instance and try to think about the reversibility of this reaction, where I push this in and push out the CH3 group with a negative charge, this is a very strong base. this base, if I look at its conjugate, methane has a pKa that is equal to 60. And so when I think about the conjugate acid of hydronium, the conjugate acid of hydronium has a pKa of minus 1. pKa 60 versus minus 1, if we use those strengths to sort of figure out how weak or strong the other conjugate is. Remember that conjugates run in opposite. So whatever is a strong acid, then its conjugate starts off, oops, that's not the right direction for that arrow. The conjugate starts off at a weak base. So the stronger the acid, the weaker the base. So if I look at pKa minus 1, that's a really strong acid, its conjugate is a weak base, pKa 15.7. If the conjugate is a very, very weak acid, 60, then its conjugate base is going to be an extraordinarily strong base. So this definition or idea of good leaving group being a weak base allows us to understand a little bit about why a group may leave, because a weak base is very stable. So when we say stable, this guy coming off is stable, whereas the strong base is very unstable. Too high in energy. So it's about how stable the group is that's leaving that plays into the weakness or strength of the bond is one way to think about it. There are a number of different ways that we can think about it. Elian, is there going to be exceptions, like something, one group that can be both poor or... No, there's not a whole lot of exceptions with this. That's a good question. No, that what we have is a good leaving group, is a weak base, and that there aren't exceptions to that. We will see that sometimes a leaving group, I always try to think about all the exceptions and run through all the exceptions in my head. Sometimes what we'll see is that we can have a leaving group that is a poor leaving group, and we can still have that leaving group leave under the right conditions, but that doesn't make it a good leaving group. It just makes it the right conditions for that leaving group to leave. So that's a great question. Thank you, Elian. Okay, what else do I need to show you here? Quick review of the things that I need to do. Yes, okay. Some more one-way reactions versus reversible reactions. So here's another reversible reaction where a bromide can come off, leaving behind the carbocation and the bromide anion. Again, this was a good leaving group as the bromide ion is large and polarizable and stable with a negative charge. This reaction, this is a carbanion reacting to take a proton. This is more one way, and this is due not to a good leaving group or poor leaving group, but something that has a pKa equal to 15.7 versus pKa roughly 60. So that this one, the equilibrium is so tiny as to not be reversible because of pKa's. So pKa's, the differences in the pKa 15.7 versus 60 makes it difficult to have this reaction be reversible. Let me think if I could think of another one. Yes, this one's reversible. If I have an anion taking a proton to make isopropyl alcohol, or tertiary butyl alcohol, sorry, and hydroxide. This one is reversible. And this one goes back to pKa's as well. The pKa is 15.7 for the water, and pKa 18 for the tertiary butanol. So because the pKa's are similar, then I have an equilibrium that can establish. Each pKa point is an order of magnitude, is correct. Yes, Eric, an order of magnitude meaning that it is an order of a power of 10, essentially. So these are log units. So each pKa is one log unit or one order of magnitude or one power of 10. That is correct. So that those pKa's 15.7 to 60 is an enormous difference versus 15.7, 17, 16 to 18 is still an order of magnitude, but not on the same order that 15 to 60 is. So we have within a couple of pKa units, we can have reversible protonations, deprotonations. When it is orders of magnitude different, 15 to 60, then it's a one-way type of reaction. We can see that again, here's another example, reversible versus irreversible. If we have a carboxylic acid and the deprotonation by hydroxide to take the proton away, we can think about this as a reversible reaction. In water, the pKa's were 4.8 for the carboxylic acid and 15.6, 15.7 for the water. And so that one is reversible. Similarly, these are still, we would say that the equilibrium is going to lie in favor of the right-hand side with the weaker acid, but still an equilibrium there. Not 100% one direction as it would be with the 60 to 15. And one other thing that makes a reaction be one direction, irreversible, is when we get certain types of chemical reactions that produce gases. So for instance, here, what we have is an azide that can come off and leaves the reaction vessel as nitrogen gas. And when you have a component that leaves the reaction, then the reaction is irreversible. Okay, so the things that are making reactions irreversible, poor leaving groups. So a poor leaving group will make a reaction irreversible. Significant difference, application just froze, I apologize. Differences in pKa's. So that when we look at the difference in pKa's, such as here, differences in pKa's can make a reaction irreversible. If the reaction is very similar in pKa, then the reaction is a reversible reaction. And the other thing that can make an irreversible reaction is to have a gas or component that either precipitates out, so either a solid that precipitates out or a gas formation that leaves the reaction vessel. Some change of phase that causes the reaction to not be reversible is the other thing. Colin, what is the cutoff for pKa? That's a good question. I would say that I don't have a good number to give you for a cutoff, but I would say somewhere in the order of 20 pKa units, that by the time you get to a difference of 20 pKa units, you're looking at an irreversible reaction as opposed to a reversible one. That would be sort of just a general number that I would throw out there. I don't get into it in terms of that. And I don't generally ask you what's reversible versus irreversible. It's just as we start talking about reaction mechanisms, this concept or idea of reversibility versus irreversibility comes up. And so we address it in this section. Okay, that gets us out of chapter 6 and into chapter 7, which is an exciting thing because chapter 7 is where we start dealing with chemical reactions. So no longer are we looking at just physical properties of the molecules and trying to understand all the underlying physical properties. So far, what we have addressed is we have addressed acidity and basicity, so that we have looked at the structure of molecules and understood acidity and basicity and being able to judge which molecule is the stronger acid, which molecule is the stronger base. We've done that within a molecule too, so that we could look at protons and figure out which proton is most acidic, or we could look at the heteroatoms and figure out which heteroatom is most basic. So we've done those types of work. We have talked about energy diagrams. We've talked about resonance and done a lot with resonance and looked at stability according to resonance. We've looked at the underlying factors of how resonance stacks up against electronegativity, stacks up against sterics, stacks up against size of an element, all of those factors. We've talked about steric factors and conformational differences in both linear molecules and chair molecules. And so we have hit all of the major factors that will contribute into chemical reactivity. Now we need to apply them to chemical reactivity. And we start in chapter 7 with substitution reactions. So this marks a transition in what we're looking at in terms of we've studied all the foundational stuff and we've spent a good number of weeks now studying all the foundational stuff. Now we start applying those foundations to the actual chemical reactions and trying to understand the chemical reactions on everything that we've already understood. And so I will constantly harken back to all the things that we've already studied and ask you to remember all those things that we've already done. Okay, so chapter 7, we start off with a little bit of nomenclature because we're going to be looking at some new molecules. And then we jump into substitution reactions and different rate orders, substitution first order, substitution second order. And then in chapter 8, we go into elimination reactions. And then in the next chapter, we put them all together and look at them all together as a group of reactions that that are all competing and how to understand how they all compete. So we're going to understand the reaction mechanism of each and then throw them all in together and look at them all together. Okay, so chapter 7. This is substitution reactions. And we do SN1 and SN2. Substitution, nucleophilic first order. Actually, I think it's supposed to be SN1 and SN2 with a superscript. Substitution, nucleophilic first order and substitution, nucleophilic second order. But we're going to start off with a little bit of nomenclature. Okay. Let's see if we could just name this compound. If we go through and number it, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, we have two different substituents. We have the bromine and we have the methyl group. So we have a 2-methyl and we have a 2-bromo. And it's a pentane. And so we throw those components together, alphabetizing bromo before methyl, and we get 2-bromo, 2-methyl, pentane. Let's do this one. Okay, so in numbering this one, best place to start numbering is to number the methyl groups because the methyl groups are going to be a 1,1-dimethyl. That will be my first point of difference. And I could number around clockwise or counterclockwise, but because I will hit the first substituent counterclockwise, that would be the right way to number. What happened there? 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah, I'm good. It looked like my 6 was landing on the same place as my 1, but they were just close together. So I have a 2-chloral. But what is this thing? What is that group that is there? That's a stereo center, right? So we can't just leave a stereo center without giving the stereo center nomenclature. So we'll have to go through and analyze that stereo center for a second. Let's redraw it so that my numbering system doesn't get in the way of my stereochemistry. So as I go through and number for stereochemistry, chlorine is going to get number 1. The ring system over here, number 2, 3, and 4. 4 is already back. I'm sweeping around in a clockwise orientation. This is an R stereo center. So the stereo center that I have is a 2R stereo center. And this is a cyclohexane. So I put that all together and I alphabetize the chloro before the methyl. So I get 2R, stereo centers always go first, 2R, 2-chloro, 1,1-dimethyl, cyclohexane. And we got to fit the cyclohexane in there. Should be all one word. Let's just move it over so that we can fit it all in. Cyclohexane. No space between dimethyl and cyclohexane. So that fits in that part. All right. So that's just a review of the nomenclature that we've had to date. Let's put some new nomenclature in. Rules for alcohols. The alcohol must be part of the parent chain and have the lowest possible number. That's a rule for now. Later on, alcohols can be substituents, but right now the alcohol is going to be the parent, and the alcohol must be part of the parent chain, must be part of the longest chain, and the alcohol must get the lowest possible number on the numbering system. So it changes it from other substituents. So what we have is, if we have an alcohol that looks like this, then when we do the numbering system, although we could number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and let's number down this way, 6, or I could number this way, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. On the green system, I would have 2 substituents, and it would be a 2, 2, 5 for the alcohol. On the red system, it would be a 2, 5, 5. Normally, we would want to go with the green numbering system because it would be the lowest numbers at the first point of difference. However, what's more important is that the alcohol get the lowest possible number. So it's no longer the lowest number at first point of difference. It's now that the alcohol must get the lowest possible number. So I want to make that clear as we go through and number that. So that means that the red system is going to be the appropriate numbering system, not the green. And so this is going to have the alcohol on number two. It's going to have a 5-5 dimethyl. The parent chain is a 6-carbon, so that's a hexane. But what we're going to do is we're going to drop off the E and we're going to add the OL, telling us what alcohol this is. And so the name comes together and it becomes 5-5 dimethyl hexan-2-ol, hexanol. So this is a hexanol alcohol, and the locator for the alcohol comes just before the OL. Okay, another example. Let's put a stereocenter into the next example. Kind of want to leave that one up there so you guys can see it. Next example is a 5-membered ring system, hydroxyl group. We'll put in the dimethyl and we'll put in an ethyl group. So we've got two stereocenters that we've got to deal with. In this case, let's get both of the stereocenters and then we'll get a numbering system and then we'll figure out kind of where everything goes. So we'll take this guy, we'll copy it, we'll paste it, so that we can do each of the stereocenters separately. First stereocenter, hydroxyl is going to get number one. The carbon, this carbon here is a carbon that has three other carbons attached. So it gets priority number two. The carbon here has two hydrogens and only one carbon attached. So it gets a lower priority. So that's priority number three. And number four is the hydroxyl group. I'm sweeping around in a clockwise orientation. The first stereocenter is an R. The second stereocenter, we'll put the hydrogen in there. This time, as I go around and I try to figure out prioritizations, let's zoom in on this one a little bit more because the prioritizations on this one is a little bit tricky. So trying to figure out this stereocenter is a good practice question. All right, we know that the hydrogen is going to get number four, the lowest priority. But at each one of these groups, I have the same sort of carbon. I have a carbon with two hydrogens and another carbon attached. Two hydrogens and another carbon, which means that I'm going to have to extend my search out to try to find the first point of difference. So we'll have to go out one more carbon. So what I'm going to do is let's sort of switch colors. We'll follow, that's too big a brush. Let's follow this system out this direction. We'll follow this system out this direction. And we will follow this guy out this direction. So on the red path is taking me to a carbon here, which is connected to three other carbons. The blue path is taking me out to a carbon, which has a hydrogen, a carbon, and an oxygen attached. So oxygen, carbon, hydrogen, in no particular order, just listing them out. And the purple path took me out to a carbon that had three hydrogens on it. Okay, so now we can find our prioritizations. What we do is we prioritize the blue one first because of the oxygen. So that's going to be the highest priority. Then the next highest priority will be the carbon. And the lowest priority will be the one with the three hydrogens on it, will be the purple one. So purple is going to take number three. So we'll go three out that direction. We'll go one for blue. And we'll go two for red. And the hard part here is this hydrogen is forward. So that means that I'm going to reverse everything. So when I take and I put that group back, what that's going to do is I'll rotate the molecule around so that we can kind of see it, and I'll draw it in a Newman sort of projection. And the way that I'm going to flip it is I'm sort of going to take the molecule and I'm going to flip it back this way so that the hydrogen goes back, and I'm going to take the ethyl group and I'm going to put the ethyl group up. So my ethyl group is going to go straight up like this. That means that the rest of the ring system is down. And as I do that, the blue from the ring system comes over this direction. And the red from the ring system comes over this direction. And this gives me the dimethyl groups. This is the ring connection itself. And the hydroxyl, without putting the stereo center on it, the hydroxyl is sitting on this carbon. And so my prioritizations, as I went through and added those prioritizations, this guy took 3, this guy took 2, that guy took 1, and the hydrogen is back. So I am sweeping in this orientation. That is a counterclockwise orientation. That is an S stereo center. That was sort of a tour de force of getting that stereo center and understanding what that stereo center is. Okay, now we've got to paste this system in one more time. And now that we understand our stereo systems, now we've got to do numbering for naming. The hydroxyl group has to get the lowest possible number. We number around the first point of difference to the methyls, 2, 3, 4, 5. So this is a cyclopentane. We're going to throw this off and it's going to become an alcohol. It is a 2,2 dimethyl. It is a 1-all. It is a 4 ethyl. And it is a 1R and 4S. So 1R comma 4S. There's our stereocenters. So we put all that together into the name, and alphabetizing, we are going to put ethyl ahead of methyl. So, and stereocenters go in first. So it is a 1R comma 4S dash 4-ethyl dash 2,2-dimethyl. Cyclopentan-1-all. That was a lot of nomenclature. How are you guys doing? Okay, so you followed everything that I did. Cool. Okay.
Jason, quick question. Why did you put the 1-all? Why wouldn't you just leave it like, you know,
cycle? Pentanol?
Yeah.
Because you could leave it as pentanol and not put the 1 in there. The 1 is redundant, but the 1 is appropriate and proper for the name. So that because the alcohol could be in a number of different locations, we want to make sure that the alcohol gets the number. It's the proper way to name the molecule. So even when the alcohol is on carbon number 1, unless it's a simple molecule like ethanol or N-propanol or something where the hydroxyl group is on a straight chain in the number 1 position, even when it is in the 1 position, it's proper IUPAC to include the number and to locate the functional group. Okay? All right, classifications. So, in classifications, we're looking at the type of functional group that we have. These guys are primary. So this is a primary alkyl halide and a primary alcohol. And by primary, what we're saying is that they're connected to a carbon that has two hydrogens on it. They're on the terminal end. And by primary, we write it with a one like that. So they're connected to a CH2 group. So that is my point of connection at a CH2 group, means that it's primary. If the alkyl halide is connected in the middle of the molecule, or the alcohol is connected in the middle of the molecule, this is said to be secondary. So these are connected on a carbon, which is connected to two other carbons. So we look at really what we're tracking is we're really tracking how many other carbons the carbon is connected to. For instance, the carbon that the alcohol is connected to here has two hydrogens on it and is connected to one other carbon. Thus, that's where the primary comes from. The secondary comes from the idea that the alcohol or the alkyl halide is connected to a carbon. So this is the alcohol or alkyl halide that is connected to two other carbons. And that is where the secondary idea comes from. If the alkyl halide or hydroxyl group are connected to a carbon connected to three other carbons, then we say this is tertiary. So again, this is a carbon which is connected to three other carbons. Finley is deciding to sound off in the other room. So there's our tertiary. So that's how we refer to alcohols as either primary, secondary, or tertiary. Alkyl halides, primary, secondary, or tertiary. Do I still, Ellen, do I still use N with rings? No, N is for normal. Ooh, that goes back up to this nomenclature thing. 1, 2, 3, 4. This is N-butanol. The lowercase n equals normal. This would be synonymous with 1-butanol. Or in the newer IUPAC standard, butan-1-ol. These are all acceptable names. And the lowercase n means normal. If we have uppercase N, this is N-methyl. What is that? Ethylamine. Or we could say N-methyl and ethylamine. The capital N means attached to nitrogen. So a lowercase n means normal, whereas an uppercase n means attached to a nitrogen element. So the difference is in the nomenclature. So just to be careful when you're using uppercase versus lowercase. Good question, thank you. Okay. Because we're going to be looking at molecules that also have double bonds in them, it's appropriate to understand the nomenclature that we have around double bonds. These groups are said to be vinyl or vinylic. So a vinyl hydroxyl group or a vinyl chloride, that's a vinyl position. If we have the double bond and we are one carbon off the double bond, then these are allylic. So this is an allylic hydroxyl group, or an allylic chloride, allyl or allylic. And then off a triple bond, not that way, but one carbon displaced, chloride versus hydroxyl. These are propargylic. Propargyl or propargylic. It's the way that we refer to those. Okay. So all of these types of terms, as we start talking about the reactions, there are ways of describing positions within a molecule so that we have a common language that we're using so that you guys aren't wondering what it is that I'm saying. And I'll remind you and show the functional groups as I go through and do that. And the other day, we also talked about the different types of carbon. So, and we sort of did this up above too, that I can have a type of carbon which is quaternary. I could have a type of carbon which is tertiary, a secondary, or primary. And these guys out here are also all primary. So that, let's take and I can put, let's put primary at red. So I have a primary carbon. We can do secondary, tertiary, and finally quaternary. So we have all the different types of carbon that are in there. So it's important that primary isn't always the end of the longest chain. Primary is just where there is a methyl group, a CH3 group. So a CH3 group is what is primary, is what I'm, the way that I think about that. So a CH3 group is a primary group. A CH2 group is a secondary group. A tertiary group is a CH group, which is connected at three other locations. And then, of course, the quaternary position is a carbon which is attached to four other carbons. So that's how we look at each one of those. Katrina, it's a nitrogen. Wait, Francisco, I got to back up. A nitrile, is it one carbon displaced as well? A nitrile group, I haven't seen, we don't usually say nitrile, N-I-T-R-Y-L. Usually nitrile, I-L-E, which is a carbon triple bound to a nitrogen, which is a nitrile group. As far as I know, there is no nitrile. It's not a term with a YL that we refer to in that way. I think that's the answer to the question that you're looking for, Francisco. Okay. All right, checking time, where we're at and what I want to do. Let's look at some substitution reactions and start off with substitutions. So in substitution reactions, what we have is a leaving group on a carbon chain, a nucleophile, and the nucleophile replaces the leaving group. And I'm purposely not putting any sort of charges or anything on these. We'll talk about charges in a little bit, but the general rate of these types of chemical reactions is that tertiary carbons react faster than secondary, react a lot faster than primary for our leaving group. Meaning that a leaving group that is on a tertiary carbon, the reaction is going to go faster than a leaving group which is on a secondary carbon, which is going to go a lot faster than a leaving group which is on a primary carbon. For these general reaction rates, that's what we're saying in terms of tertiary versus secondary versus primary. Let's give some examples of these types of reactions and what they can look like. I try to keep my general rates as general as I possibly can without ever even putting a molecule together and just looking at what the overall reaction looks like. And the idea or goal here is for you guys to try to pattern these reactions, not so much on a specific substrate, because if you look at it substrate wise, what you're going to feel is that every chemical reaction is unique, but to try to find them in terms of the reaction pattern so that you can see the similarities, not the differences. We're trying to find similarities in these chemical reactions rather than the differences. So here's an example. We can have a bromide, which is a secondary bromide, reacting with sodium methyl sulfide in THF at 25 degrees Celsius to form the sulfur attached to the substrate plus sodium bromide coming off as a leaving group. Or sodium, not as a leaving group, the bromide came off as a leaving group, but the sodium bromide is the salt that winds up forming. And this reacts in 95% to give a 95% yield. We would refer to this as a secondary alkyl bromide. This is the substrate. This group up here is the nucleophile. And then we have two other things. We have reaction conditions, solvent and temperature. The solvent, THF, is a molecule called tetrahydrofuran. And the temp is at 25 degrees. I'm going to throw a lot of different solvents at you and a lot of different conditions. And the idea there is to, number one, get you to see a lot of different solvents and conditions. And the other one is to desensitize you to a lot of different information coming in a chemical reaction to focus on what is important. So it's like desensitizing you to violence on television, where all of a sudden you watch a lot of shows with just a tremendous amount of violence and you don't even see the violence anymore. You just sort of watch for the plot. I have the same sort of theory about organic chemistry, that I need to teach you to focus on what is the important component and what is not important. And by throwing a lot of things at you, you start to learn what to filter out and what to pay attention to. So there are going to be times where we'll pay attention to solvents and temperatures and all those things. But for right now, we're going to kind of learn to filter them out. And so I'll just be throwing a bunch of different things at you. Let's take a tertiary butanol and react it with HCl, hydrochloric acid, at 25 degrees Celsius. And this makes tertiary butyl chloride plus water. And this goes in about 82% yield. So the chloride is replacing the hydroxyl group. Substitution reactions. Cyclohexanol reacting with HCl reacts at 100 degrees C to give the similar sort of product plus water. And the 1-propanol reacts with HCl at 120 degrees to give a similar sort of product. Let's see, yields were 73% and 90%. Okay, what do we see here in this trend? What we see in this trend is that I start off with a relatively cold temperature of 25 degrees C, and that this was a tertiary alcohol. When I go to a secondary alcohol, I needed to warm this up a bit and do it at 100 degrees. When I go to a primary alcohol, now I'm heating this quite dramatically and I'm at 120 degrees. And so what you're seeing is that idea of chemical rate, that tertiary substrates react faster than secondary substrates, react faster than primary substrates. The fact that I'm increasing the temperature in this chemical reaction is a reflection of how much energy it takes for the reaction to go forward. And remember that reaction rate is related to activation energy, so that what we're saying is that the activation energy in terms of this alcohol reacting to form the alkyl halide is fairly small, but the activation energy for each one of these chemical reactions is increasing. That one needs to be even a little bit higher. And that I'm increasing in reaction rate at each step. Now, these are not necessarily a binary unimolecular reaction rate, but I'm just trying to catch the idea of activation energy and an increasing activation energy with each one of these steps related to our leaving group, in whether it's tertiary, primary, or secondary. How would different halides affect this? Yes, Eric, we're going to get to that. I'm not going to do that now. Katrina, if the two later reactions were not heated, would they not occur? They would occur, but at a much slower rate, such that if we stopped each one of these reactions at 15 minutes, the first reaction would go to completion, the second reaction would be somewhere in the middle, and the third reaction would barely be starting. So that if we ran them all at the same temperature, the rate at which the product is forming is different. The fact that I am increasing the temperature is that I'm trying to get them all done within 15 minutes. And so so I'm increasing the temperature to try to get them all done at the same time, essentially, which is playing into the activation energy for the chemical reaction. Remember that we can look at these, that if I have a Boltzmann distribution of molecules, that I could look at the small e sub A. So this would be for the tertiary, the e sub A for the secondary, and the e sub A for the primary, and that because this is relative energy, that what I would say is that all of the molecules that are, what color did I make it, blue? So that if I'm thinking about this as being the e sub A for the primary, that all of these molecules would be able to get over the activation energy barrier. But when I get to the secondary, only these molecules would be able to make it over the activation energy barrier. When I get to the primary, only these molecules would be able to make it over the activation energy barrier. So that tells you how far the reaction runs to completion within a given time, given a Boltzmann distribution of molecules all at the same temperature. So this would be all molecules at the same temperature, and how many molecules would be able to make it over that activation energy barrier. I hope that helps, Katrina. Eric, we're going to catch your question a little bit later. So that's a great question, but that needs to be dealt with on a different day. Let's see, what else do I need to show you? Oh, some other ideas, some other concepts. That if we take that same alcohol that was primary and we treat it with H2SO4 and sodium chloride and some heat, that we can also get the substitution to go at about an 80% yield. Byproducts out of this are water and sodium hydrogen sulfate, which looks very different than just HCl, so that we could have acid in there, but the nucleophile can come from a salt, which is sort of a different sort of concept. Another example, we could take an alkyl halide, a bromide, and react it with methanol and heat. And we can make the alcohol plus HBr. We could take a primary alkyl halide and treat it with a salt, sodium ethoxide, in ethanol. And we can make the ether, plus we make sodium chloride here. So what's fascinating about this is that looking at all these different chemical reactions, there doesn't seem to be any sort of uniform what is a substitution reaction, other than the fact that I have a leaving group and some nucleophile that is coming in and replacing, although that nucleophile doesn't have to be an acid. The nucleophile can be a salt. So the nucleophile could be a salt, whereas these nucleophiles were HCl, were acid. Here the nucleophile was a salt, same as here. But sometimes the nucleophile can just be an alcohol, and it can show up in the product as well. So what we're seeing is that there's a lot of diversity here, and we need to make sense out of this diversity and break it down into specific types of classes of reactions and start making some sense out of it. So what we're going to do is we're going to break it down into the different types of substitution reactions, such that there are two types. We're dealing with SN1, which is a substitution nucleophilic first order. And that's a first order rate law. So that's what we mean by first order. And SN2, which is substitution nucleophilic second order. And that means second order rate law. So we're going to pick first the SN2 reaction. And we're going to go through what that reaction looks like. And I'm trying to figure out where I want to leave it here. Let's just look at the rate of this reaction just really quick. The rate is equal to the rate constant times the substrate concentration times the nucleophile concentration. And that these types of chemical reactions frequently look like this. We have a substrate with a leaving group reacting with some nucleophile that generally has a negative charge on it, but not always, goes to make our nucleophile plus the leaving group, which then has the negative charge on it. And that by being second order, what we're saying is that the rate is dependent on both the substrate concentration and the nucleophile concentration, and that there must be a chemical collision between the two substrates, the substrate and the nucleophile, in order for the reaction to take place, such that these two must actually hit, and the nucleophile must hit the substrate in order to knock out the leaving group. And that without that collision, that the reaction doesn't take place. And so the fact that it takes a collision between the two molecules is where the bimolecular rate constant comes from. That's our second order. I should say second order, not, eraser. Oh no, I stalled. Okay. That was pretty much where I wanted to end it anyway, but I want to finish that note. Okay, so this is now a second order rate law. There's a lot here to unpack, and what we're going to do is we're going to go through each of the reaction mechanisms, understand from the mechanism, use Hammond postulate to understand what the transition state looks like in the reaction mechanism. And then from Hammond postulate, we can examine all the properties which will affect the rate of the chemical reaction. And from there, we can build out an understanding of the chemical reaction and generalize then for the chemical reaction the different rates for the different primary, secondary, tertiary substrates, how leaving group affects, so that we can address Eric's question of how would the different halides affect this. So we could look at all different leaving groups, not just halides. We could look at a lot of different leaving groups and how they affect the chemical reaction. We could look at sterics and how sterics affects the chemical reaction. And we'll understand the reaction at its foundation of how all these different physical properties and chemical properties and reaction conditions affect the chemical reaction and thereby gain control over the chemical reaction so that we can build chemical reactions to be able to do what it is that we want to do. That's where we're going with all of this. And so on Wednesday, Wednesday's lecture is going to be a great lecture. It's one of my favorite topics to talk about. And I'm really excited that we're at this point in the semester because this is where we really get to do some great things. And it's where we start talking about chemical reactions for the first time and all the properties that go into them. And I get to remind you of everything that we've already done and already studied. And we just start bringing everything together and synthesizing it. So before where we were just talking about sterics or just talking about resonance, or it's a little bit like the acid base where there was a lot of different factors, those four different factors that came into acid base and trying to decide, well, is resonance the bigger factor or sterics the bigger factor or is it size or is it electronegativity? All of those factors play into these rates as well. And yet we have a lot of different properties of the molecule to look at and how solvent plays into it and all those different things. And so all of a sudden we start juggling more balls and we just start doing a lot more of what we think of as organic chemistry rather than just studying structure itself. We actually get to study mechanism, which is one of my favorite things to study. So I'm excited about this. I hope you're excited about this. And if there's any other questions, feel free to hang out and ask questions. And if not, then I'll see you guys in the afternoon for lab. We've got a great lab lecture for the afternoon group too, because we're doing our first chemical reaction in lab. And that's an exciting lab to talk about as well. So throw some questions at me if you got them. I'll hang around for a little bit. I'll be back for office hours at 1:30 if you want to jump in for that. And we've got lab lecture this afternoon at 2:00. So thank you guys. And I'll see you in the afternoon.
It also looks like more people than not just said to keep it where it was.
Okay.
I know there was a few people that wanted it, but I guess I'll probably just keep SI. Like, I'll send out an email and I'll log on earlier and leave later, but it seems like more people wanted just that set time.
Okay. Sounds good. Because they kind of had that blocked out in their time, so that makes it easier for them.
Yeah, so I think I'll just keep it there. So I'm sorry to whoever wanted to meet today, but I can answer questions like online too. So,
or they can jump into my office hours this afternoon.
Yeah,
turkey.
Yeah. Or that.
Or that, sure. All right.
Thank you, Jason. Have a good day.
Thanks,
Samaya.
Thanks, Jason.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Jason. See you on Wednesday.
All right. You're welcome, Eric.
Or, wait, no. See you for lab.
Oh, yeah. Lab this afternoon.